Penguin Random House Audio presents We Refuse to Forget, a true story of Black Creeks, American identity, and power. This is the author, Caleb Gale. A note to my listeners. This audio recording includes racial slurs as they appear in quotations. They are included because I believe it is vital that readers and listeners understand how normalized they were in that era and for generations that followed. For Peanut, for the fam, and for those whose stories are yet to be told. Introduction. I got Indian in me. It seemed that to capture the multiplicity and contradictory nature of this past, I would have to tell at least two stories, sketch two histories, enter two worlds, enlist two purposes, and sound two calls for justice at once. Dr. Taya Miles. My Jamaican family moved from New York City to Tulsa, Oklahoma, in the late 1990s with few expectations of running into a Black person. In a place that at the time was far less Black than the New York we had left, we were desperate to find people whose skin resembled ours in the institutions that could make us feel at home. Soon after moving, my parents found a Black church in North Tulsa, the part of the city where most of the Black people live and the place where 70 years earlier, Black Wall Street once stood tall and sprawled wide. When I was a kid there, most of these Black folks, especially those who had some history in this buckle of the Bible Belt, were known to say a peculiar and delicate phrase that now sounds so familiar. I got Indian in me. Their ancestors likely included people who had called one of the Five Nations home. I didn't know it then, but the Five Nations were actually called Five Civilized Tribes, an even more indelicate way of designating the Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Creek, and Seminole Indians in Oklahoma since at least 1866. But the kids who'd say that likely did not know this history, and neither did I. They passed as simply Black. At least I thought they did. As a child, I thought that Black people in America came from only a few places. From Africa and recently from a Caribbean country like my parents also recently, or by way of slave ships from the African continent hundreds of years ago. I assume the kids who said I got Indian in me were spreading myths or trying to explain why their skin was somewhat lighter and their hair a bit curlier than mine. But I dismissed these ideas too early. Those kids did not know the historical power they wielded in that phrase, because what they were saying was a simple sentence born of a strange, forgotten history, one hard to imagine in the bright bustle of turn of the millennium America. Even in the second decade of the 21st century, as Oklahoma fights over land, as courthouses hear challenges over identity, and as Congress is called to admit a new Cherokee representative, it is hard to grasp. But it is true. What my young friends didn't know when they boasted about their DNA was that their Native and Black ancestors walked hundreds of miles together from the southeastern United States to reach what became Oklahoma. Nor did they know that some of these Black ancestors came as slaves, others as adopted citizens, and still others as fully recognized members of the Creek Nation. And I'm willing to bet that none of them ever heard the name of one Black man, a former putative slave who walked the Trail of Tears, a man dubbed Cow Tom by his former owner, a Creek chief. Like countless Native Americans, Cow Tom made that long, dangerous trek before he ultimately rose to leadership within the Creek Nation. In fact, it was Cow Tom who kept my friend's Creek identity intact when he negotiated an 1866 treaty with the U.S. government, an agreement that included citizenship rights for all Black people within the Creek Nation, whether slave, adopted, or free. It may seem odd that a son of Jamaican parents would find his way inside American history, especially inside the history of Black people about whom you've likely never heard in a state you've likely never visited. Like all history, how it started wasn't how anyone expected it to end. One day in 2019, I was sitting in the New York office of the British newspaper, The Guardian. I had worked there as a writer for 4 or 5 months. On this day, I was jostling between empty rooms and unoccupied desks while more senior writers and editors went to meetings, lunches, and vacations. I had no story on the books, and my editor and I had a meeting soon to figure out what I'd write next. I sat at my computer and typed www.tulsaworld.com into my web browser, not because I was looking for inspiration, but because I wanted a reminder that people could cover news and write stories about places and people most of the world didn't care about. What came up across the top of the Tulsa World's homepage were familiar faces and a story that claimed that the black people in the accompanying picture had been members of a nation that wasn't the United States and had freedom that their ancestors had given them in the Creek Nation, but not in the United States. I was intrigued and called some friends I grew up with, many of whom had told me when we were kids that they were part Indian. I knew I had a story, but I didn't realize that the piece I'd eventually write for The Guardian would lead me on a journey that reconfigured my notions of identity, race, and belonging. Looking back, it's odd that I wrote a story about Oklahoma, a place I wanted to forget, and a state whose mere mention often prompted any friend from anywhere else to ask, "Where is Oklahoma again?" In telling you about the place that became my home, I can tell you about America and how America fashions its identity. And if the story has shown me anything, it's that there's nothing simple about who you are or where you come from. Like the people on the front page of the Tulsa World, descendants of Cow Tom and other black citizens of the Creek Nation, we are all beautifully complex. And there's nothing more American than struggling to fit all that complexity into boxes you did not create in the first place. We often forget who we are because we have never been given the chance to remember properly. The anti-lynching memorial at the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, offers a radical chance to remember not just the highlights of the civil rights movement, but also the true pain and brutality of our nation's past. Such painful remembering of the violence that white people perpetrated against black people is required before we can build true racial reconciliation. Remembering with eyes wide open, I believe, is the first step to living out our moral obligations today. The fact that my classmates and I in Tulsa in the late 20th century didn't understand where we came from wasn't just bad schooling. It was the result of a deliberate attempt to prevent us from remembering, which is another way of saying that from an early age, black people were stopped from working to change a world that had been built on racialized, violent foundations. But what if we did know? What if we all knew about this story? Knowing this history would make the truth clearer. We'd know, for example, that Tulsa's struggles over land use, development, and zoning mask a larger story, one where city planners deliberately designed the city to ensure that different non-white populations would compete with one another instead of banding together to push back against the white ruling class. We'd know that the Cherokee people have as much right to seat a representative in Congress as do Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia. And they have this right based on signed treaties with the U.S. government, which the government has chosen to ignore. We'd know that the black members of the Creek Nation who were ejected from the tribe in 1979 should be reinstated into their political homeland. Nothing should be allowed to nullify the cultural promise and legal compact between the founding nation and its new members, no matter their race or background. And we'd know once and for all that white power and white supremacy are as old as the nation itself, as dangerous today as they were centuries ago. The history of Cow Tom's people demonstrates that white identity is too often used as a tool to divide those who are deemed other, irrelevant, or dangerous. And we'd know that white supremacy's true goal is to violently disrupt lives where there is money to be made and to erase from our collective cultural and political memories any path to becoming American that white men did not create. At the same time, knowing this history also makes some ideas less clear. For example, it's an open question just how the descendants of Creek freedmen identify today. Some see themselves as Black, others as Indigenous, others as both, and others as simply American, because they, like most of us, just don't know whence they came. How should the country at large see these people? What duties does the government have to such an aggrieved, narrowly defined group of people? Do these labels matter? And perhaps the broadest question of all, what is the past and future of identity in America? For himself and his family, Cow Tom secured land, built a home, and grew wealthy. He left his family the guarantee of full citizenship in the Creek Nation, even when the U.S. government did not provide Blacks the same courtesy. He left for his descendants breadcrumbs to guide them on their journey to define their identity, tools to advocate for the citizenship he helped to secure. Cow Tom founded a home for Black people in the Creek Nation. Like so many of the founders of the United States, what he left us is more than just words on a constitution or platitudinous statements of values and treaties, ancestors with a famous pedigree, or artifacts from his life. He left the Creek Nation a chance to be better and his people a way to be freer. He left all of us an incredible story that once we learn it, we must then refuse to forget. We must hold fast like this family has held fast to the stories that make us who we are. Which brings me back to the article in the Tulsa World, which was an account of a lawsuit in Oklahoma that captured my attention. On one side are the plaintiffs, people who say, as their ancestors have said for more than a century, that they are both fully Black and fully Creek. They are represented by attorney Demario Solomon Simmons, who is himself directly descended from Cow Tom. On the other side is the defendant, the Creek Nation, which in 1866 signed a treaty with the U.S. government that gave certain Black people citizenship rights in the nation. Decades later, in 1979, in a prolonged yet stunning about-face, the Creek Nation took away those rights to citizenship with the approval and support of the U.S. government. The plaintiffs want to be reenfranchised, and it isn't the first time they've made such a request. And regardless of the number of times they've lodged this legal claim, they resiliently remind the courts that they want to return to and be treated as equals within the political community that is the Creek Nation. The defendant seeks to keep these people out. Creek leaders do not want anyone but the people they believe are indigenous enough to be considered citizens. And Black Creek folks are too Black to be Creek enough to have the citizenship their ancestors had. Some observers say that the Creek wish to preserve their political autonomy in the face of external meddling. Others, that the nation embraces a concept that sits uncomfortably in the United States of today, the granting or rescinding of citizenship merely because of race. The story is as odd as it sounds. One marginalized group taking another marginalized nation to court for what to outsiders might feel like hollow ends. But the descendants of Cow Tom and the descendants of other Black Creeks aren't suing just for citizenship. They're reclaiming their family's stake in the country's journey. Who they are, they know, is both fully Black and fully Creek. Citizenship in the Creek Nation gave Cow Tom's descendants land and consequently wealth, status, power, and opportunity at a time when the U.S. government wasn't ready to give Blacks the same opportunities. For Demario Solomon Simmons' ancestors, being Black didn't mean what being Black meant to others in mid-19th century America. Each of his lawsuits against the Creek Nation acknowledges the violence and disenfranchisement that crushed the lives of thousands and illuminates the overlooked, inspiring, and original ways that marginalized people pushed back, worked together, and redefined their world. Perhaps remembering a different story of Blackness can uncover new paths forward for Blackness and other marginalized identities. Perhaps refusing to forget this, a story that is uniquely American, we might carve expansive ways to also be and feel American. Because this story is as strange and terrible as it is empowering. How a collection of exiles, violently excluded by a U.S. government intent on spreading white supremacy, found a way to band together, forge new alliances, and build a new identity on the wreckage of what they'd had before. Today, how we decide who is or is not American is again a pressing question. Another is understanding how white supremacy divides marginalized groups and pits them against each other to the detriment of all. What has been at stake in this case is the chance to cement who the plaintiffs are by telling the court who they and their ancestors have been. And in their doing so, their sheer persistence to tell their own stories should signal to any person who has been marginalized, any person who has been judged for their appearance, or any person who has been denied their history, that they and their stories belong. This family story is also the story of the Black Creeks. It is the story of how America remembers itself, how it mourns, how it grows up. Demario Solomon Simmons's story, just like that of his ancestor Cal Tom, is alive and well. It is the story of you and of me. Part 1. Who We've Been. Chapter 1. Collateral Damage. He was compelled to seek safety by hasty flight. Cow Tom, Loyal Creek Abstract, number 160, 1870. For weeks, the battle had been raging not far from Cow Tom's home. Smoke from artillery fire hung in the air, and the groans of injured and dying men were constant day and night. This Civil War battle happened outside the United States, and it disrupted the lives of people the United States had turned from native dwellers to foreigners. On July 15, 1863, Major General James Blunt of the Union Army called on his 250 cavalry soldiers to bring with them their guns, swords, and four pieces of heavy artillery. Familiar sights and sounds of battle preparation animated the day. The galloping of horses, the continual barking of orders at all hours of the night, cleaning of weaponry and equipment to pass the time waiting for a battle they knew would come, even if they didn't know when. Young men had received orders from Blunt to walk along the eastern bulge of the Arkansas River in Indian Territory as they awaited to know their fates, clarity that the general just couldn't give them. Over the next 2 days, Blunt guided his troops through the last 13 miles of thicket, forest, wood, and river. For a brief 2 hours, his men, eventually a little less than 3,000 in total, sat just over a mile from the Confederate enemy, who had been resting. Blunt's soldiers grabbed water from a nearby ridge to slake their thirst and unpack their haversacks, whose contents included notes from home, Bibles, and most important, food, kept safe by the sack's stitching and weaving reinforced by tar. By 10 a.m. on July 17th, the men of the Union Army were assembled into two columns. According to Blunt, the infantry was in column by companies, the cavalry by platoons, and artillery by sections, and all closed in mass so as to deceive the enemy in regard to the strength of my force. In this order, I moved up rapidly to within 1/4 of a mile of the Confederate line, when both columns were suddenly deployed to the right and left, and in less than 5 minutes, my whole force was in line of battle, covering the enemy's entire front. The Confederates were under the command of General Douglas H. Cooper, who had been dispatched to defend what had become a major supply route. His Confederate comrades had arrived in this part of Indian Territory not more than a year before, and in short order had put up a commissary, a field hospital, arbors, and housing tents. Built along the Canadian River, the settlement had ample fresh water for both the troops and, just as important, the livestock. But this wasn't just an ideal place to set up a field hospital and house troops. The 25 miles from where General Blunt started his advance on this group of Confederate soldiers was in a town called Honey Springs, in a part of the continent that had not yet been determined to be part of either the United States or the Confederacy. This was Indian Territory. Honey Springs was along the main route that connected the outer lands that were disputed by the Union and the Confederacy, an area that included Texas, Kansas, Missouri, and Arkansas. Honey Springs was a stagecoach stop, a watering hole, and a weigh and refueling station. Along this trail, Confederate soldiers received and distributed provisions, weapons, timber, and livestock. But as the Civil War raged, this area became even more critical as the Union wanted to fight proxy battles on native land. But the land on which these soldiers fought, where men, black, white, and indigenous died, was not in America. The Civil War wasn't just fought on American soil. 107 such Civil War battles were fought outside America, fought in the metaphorical backyards of Native people. The Battle of Honey Springs took place just steps from Cowtown, whose later actions prompted generations to tell others, "I got Indian in me." The Union defeated the Confederates at Honey Springs, and in the battle's aftermath, Cooper's army looked to decamp until they determined where to go next. They came across empty homes and farms in the area in which food and water had been left by people fleeing the fighting across the region. The battles had hollowed out towns like Coosa, Coweta, Tuckabatchee, North Fork, Canadian Colored, and Arkansas Colored, Creek towns, and the land on which the Confederates fought was Creek land, belonging to the citizens of the Creek Nation. A nation once unified was scattered. Homes left in the state of people set to flee at a moment's notice, farms and cattle left unattended, ways of life abandoned. Scores of Creek families headed north to Kansas with whatever they could pack, trying to escape the war they didn't ask for. By August 1863, Confederate soldiers made their way 12 miles from North Fork, where they lost their way along the Canadian River and discovered that not all Creek territory had been abandoned. They came upon a curious group of Creek families who had stayed and who looked like the people whom neither the United States Constitution nor the Constitution of the Confederate States recognized fully as people. One of those people was Cowtown. He had stayed, and so had a host of other refugee Creeks, some of whom shared his jet-black skin tone, and some of whom didn't. When these Confederate soldiers, tired, hungry, desperate, and likely not appreciative of the Black Creek cause, descended on Cowtown's land and the land of his neighbors, it became clear that the Creeks' presence on their land wasn't greeted with enthusiasm by the Confederates. Days into the ever-growing presence of Confederate soldiers on his land, Cowtown and his wife Amy took what they could pack onto their backs and left. They walked away from everything that they had known, where they had raised a son, where they had run a gristmill, where they'd farmed and raised cattle and plunged into a dark unknown. Night was the only time they could travel because that was the only time they could move undetected. With Confederate rebels in the area doing whatever overzealous white colonists might do, claiming for themselves land and property that was someone else's, they didn't know what they'd encounter. There was no guarantee that any people they met would be friendly, particularly if those people were hungry and war-worn Confederate rebels. There was very little chance that Cowtown would be seen as what he was, fully Creek and fully Black and free. It was virtually certain that any white person they'd encounter would see Cowtown as just a slave running from his master. His days would never dull the hopes for the gristmill he once told a U.S. official he badly wanted or his dream of a school for his children and grandchildren to attend. After more than a week of being on the run, Cowtown and his band of travelers, hungry, wet from continuous rain, having suffered cold nights and been burned by the daytime sun and insufficiently nourished, came to what seemed like a place to rest. They made it to an outpost called Fort Gibson with no certainty that they'd be accepted. There was no guarantee that Fort Gibson still sat under the control of the side that was supposedly against slavery. But it didn't matter. Cal Tom was compelled to seek safety by hasty flight, he said later, because the skirmish between warring white people had laid waste to all he knew. And since he wasn't alone, and a brazen, pioneering brand of leadership seemed core to his existence, he had to lead a nation that, like so many other marginalized peoples in America, had become collateral damage to the U.S. government's ambitions. Chapter 2. Enough Family. Let's Create a Nation. The white people intend to take all their lands. Unnamed Creek Headman, May 2, 1763. Most American school children who have taken a basic history course can tell you that the United States experienced its fair share of battles before most say it was founded in 1776. As a student, I was fascinated by the stories of Pontiac, the Ottawa chief during the French and Indian War. I read as much as I could about the British, French, and American soldiers duking it out over what they saw as unsettled land, battling over who would rule this so-called new nation. I followed the stories of Spanish conquistadors owning Florida, losing Florida, and gaining Florida again, only to ultimately lose it. What this instruction didn't explore was the lives of those people who lived, cultivated, and cared for this land first. When the Europeans came to North America, indigenous groups were forced to decide how to deal with them, employing, in turn, the tools of diplomacy and the weapons of war to survive. As these invading white men took their land, indigenous people watched, fought, and prayed, as the old hymn put it, over how much of their land would be taken over. And when they inevitably were faced with deciding whom to side with and whom to oppose, these native tribes and nations faced critical decisions that would determine survival or certain death. Creeks especially had to practice a special brand of diplomacy. From 1754 to 1763, the British colonies in North America fought against New France's colonies, and both Britain and France had the help of indigenous allies. The French seemingly needed these indigenous peoples more than the British, because the British already had nearly 2 million people living in their colonies, many of whom they could conscript into battle, while the French had only about 60,000. To counteract the British superiority in numbers, the French enlisted the efforts of their so-called allies in the Wabanaki Confederacy, which contained numerous tribes, while the British had the Iroquois, the Catawba, and the Cherokee fighting for them. The British ultimately prevailed in the French and Indian War, though each side gave up land they owned, because white men get to say what they own even if they only owned it because they proclaimed it so. For the Creek, the victory for the British crown spelled an end to its preferred posture, neutrality. And the end of neutrality meant that its future would be uncertain. Before the war, the Creek maintained their neutrality, as historian Stephen Hahn put it, to defend Creek territory from unwanted intrusion of backcountry settlers, and to sit apart from those nations that pinned their hopes on one imperial colonial power triumphing over the other. Long before the extreme bloodshed of the Nine-Year War, the Creeks made clear their neutrality. In 1713, the Creeks signed what became known as the Coweta Resolution, which established their position of neutrality among Great Britain, France, and Spain. It was a uniting banner under which the Creeks became known to European colonists, standing aloof in this evolving, rapidly changing landscape. With Britain victorious in the French and Indian War, all of this changed. War no longer distracted the British crown from subordinating its colonies in North America and all who lived there, Creeks included. The Creeks long feared what would happen if one country emerged on top in this bloody war, which had taken the lives of more than 10,000 by disease, more than 1,500 by wounds, and roughly the same number killed in action. The Creeks knew then, as many learned later, that whoever won would fix their eyes on Creek land as well as the fertile lands of other indigenous people. The Creeks saw it coming. Even during the war, the British compelled the Creeks to cede parts of their territory in Georgia to the British crown, territory that the Creeks had called their own for centuries. So when the war ended, they knew what was coming. The ending of this war would start, in historian Angie DeBow's unsettling phrase, a long road to disappearance for the people who had known America long before America was America. Most nations are founded by conquest, but the British, the French, and the Spanish founded their North American colonies first on the power of their words. It is now ours. By contrast, the Creek Nation was invented by survival. Long before the British, the French, and the Spanish arrived on American shores, the predecessors to what we now call the Creek Nation formed bonds based on communal understandings of land shared one with another. But this survival enriched everyone, tribe after tribe, all bound by the realization that they all were to share the land. The Creeks were scaffolded by bonds, deep bonds. It took until the end of the Civil War for the Creek Nation to build itself into what we know it to be today, replete with a constitution that the United States recognizes, with three branches of government. But the mechanics of a government existed long before the United States asked this confederacy of kinship to become a nation. The Creek lands, now primarily southern Tennessee, all of Alabama, western Georgia, and part of northern Florida, though a smattering of settlements could be found even more expansively, were outlined by small townships often founded by families and clans that established relationships with other families and clans, often through marriage. These towns were run by councils chaired by a leader or chief called miko. Long before the British began laying claim to the nation, kinship, family, and loyalty knit together the sprawling confederation of tribes they called Creek. It is often in nostalgia, the dreaming and wishing for another moment of yesterday, that we learn most about who we were and who we could be. Pleasant Porter, a Creek chief, did a lot of dreaming. In Porter's annual address to the Creek Nation Council, he concluded with a bold remark: "The vitality of our race still persists. We have not lived for naught. We are the original discoverers of this continent and the conquerors of it from the animal kingdom, and from it first taught the art of peace and war, and first planted the institutions of virtue, truth, and liberty." No stranger to reminding white colonialists of the ingenuity of the Creek, he was clear when he said, "We have given to European people on this continent our thought forces. The best blood of our ancestors has been intermingled with their best statesmen and leading citizens. We have ourselves an indestructible element in their natural history. We have shown that what they believed to be arid and desert places were habitable and capable of sustaining millions of people. We have led the vanguard of civilization in our conflict with them for tribal existence from ocean to ocean." What Porter was hinting at was the resilience of his people in the face of the hardship brought by European settlers who had their own selfish interests. But it was his dreaming that gives the best understanding of what the Creek Nation was before white men's dictatorial rule forced the Creeks to negotiate for their survival with a figurative gun to the head of the Creek Nation. In November 1906, the Senate Select Committee to investigate matters connected with affairs in the Indian Territory heard this dream from Porter himself. "In those days, they always raised enough to eat, and that was all we wanted. We had little farms and we raised patches of corn and potatoes and poultry and pigs and horses and cattle and a little of everything, and the country was prosperous. In fact, in my early life, I don't know that I ever knew of an Indian family that were paupers. There is plenty of them now. There was none then. They were all prosperous and happy and contented in their way, and what more could they want? I say I don't know of an Indian family in my early life that were paupers. In those days, the ones that would be paupers, if they live now, stayed with their kinfolks, and they made them work. Now, back of that, the custom of the Creeks was that everybody had to work or live on the town, and the town had taskmasters who took care of him and saw that he worked. There was not a skulker or one who shirked amongst us then. Quite different from what it is now. We had a kind of an Arcadian government then. If anyone was sick or unable to work, the neighbors came in and planted his crop, and they took care of it, saw that the fences were all right. And the women took care of the garden, and wood was got for him, and so on. In fact, everything was done under the care of the people. They did everything and looked after the welfare of everything. The Creek had that much knowledge that they cared for each other in that way. And while they used to live in towns in Alabama, out here in this peaceful country, they had scattered out just like white men, and each one had gone to his farm. In those days, you know, a hog ran wild in the woods, went just where he liked, only they would be fed regularly a little corn or something to keep them kind of tame and domesticated. But now you have to keep him under fence. You can't leave him out now like then. The sheer simplicity of the time was achieved through the resilience of complex cultural norms cultivated over generations. Crop shared, caring for sick neighbors' crops and their own. The peace and tranquility of an Arcadian life. It is the power of that simplicity that held the memories of what was that propelled them to never let go of what life could be for them. As white settlers moved into different parts of what was former Creek territory, parts of Florida, Alabama, Georgia, and the Carolinas, indigenous refugees fled to other parts of the Creek Nation and integrated their traditions into those of the Creek Nation. What was originally the Muscogee then absorbed the Alabamas, the Coasatas, the Hitchites, and the Tuskegees. Long before the Creeks were given what Angie DeBow called the perilous gift of American citizenship, they had their own order and structure. Creeks had two primary parts of their government, one that recognized peace and another that recognized war. Peace towns were called white towns, and the war towns were known as red towns. Each town was normally located along the bends and curves of a river or creek to ensure adequate water supply and ample game and hunting opportunities. Cultivation and preservation were skills the Creeks practiced long before the term social movement was invented. Locations of these towns were responsive to their impact on the environment. Abandoning certain towns because of exhaustion of the fields, outbreak of a pestilence, according to DeBow. The Creek were not only industrious, they were also flexible, as the relative size and importance of every town changed based on need. The smaller towns and villages formed around larger towns, setting up independent town councils and ceremonies. Creek towns were named from historic events, as Nuyaka, often spelled New Yorker, received its name when some of the chiefs signed a treaty at New York. But most town names, like Concharty, Red Earth, Wewoka, Barking or Roaring Water, and Talasi, Old or Abandoned Town, describe the location. Colonizers often tell themselves stories that the places they have colonized were in desperate need of saving, that their colonizing was redemptive. Or at least that's what I learned in school. But despite what I learned in school, civilization was in Creek lands long before colonial settlers believed that it was. The Creeks long had policies of governance, peace, war, and treaties. They knew what it meant to organize civilization from the highest levels of governance down to the most specific and granular of details. The private dwellings of each town were grouped around a public space consisting of three units known as the Chunky Yard, the Chakofa, and the Square. These were laid out with ceremonial exactness and were swept and kept in order by individuals appointed for the purpose. In each town were councils. In times of peace, they held their council meetings in white towns where they discussed adopting conquered tribes, enacting non-war-related laws, and regulating their governments. These white towns were considered sites of refuge, and aside from enemies of the Creek Nation, no blood was to be spilled in them. Even conquered tribes usually were integrated into white towns. The Creek knew the difference between peace and comedy and war, strife, and conflict. For the Red Towns, councils focused on war, diplomatic affairs, and foreign policy. Every one of these towns had focal points of freedom and of abundant living, of toil shared in careless fellowship, of feasting, dance, and frolic, of sin and retribution and moral aspiration, all directed by the grave voice of the men in council. Creek traditions were centered in a kinship that seemingly could cross tribal barriers and embrace other tribes into its traditions, policies, and spirituality. People the European colonists once called savage had firmly established their own brand of civilization, creating peace and accommodating different perspectives, races, and religions long before Europeans cravenly landed on America's shores. I grew up being taught that the nation's modernization was the most recent accomplishment of landed, westernized, elite men. But the lives of the Creek were led with a level of skill untouched by, not born from, Western influence. Their lives were not about survival, as they would later become. Their lives were about abundance. But then came survival of a different sort for the Creeks to contend with, the survival of white supremacy. The United States was not particularly interested in this curious assemblage of kinship that characterized the Creeks and other indigenous peoples. You cannot abolish bonds of kinship cemented in faith, religion, culture, tradition, and laws. But a nation? A nation can be destroyed. One nation can establish laws and rules that divide members of another nation who once considered each other family. A nation can be negotiated with, not always in good faith, and not be subject to the principles of love and friendship that permeated this kinship. As a result, Creek towns were no longer strictly centers of culture and family and togetherness. They became capitals that Europeans would visit, prospect, and negotiate. The moment these Creek towns and their ways of life became subject to the ambitions of their white peers working for another government, the goal of white supremacy was to ensure that, as Cheryl Harris thought, only white possession and occupation of land could be validated. Creek life that had been theirs for generations was being invalidated by the growing American nation. I may not know the exact origins of the conventions and quirks of my Jamaican identity, but I know that what makes it akin to the origins of Cow Tom's Black Creek heritage is that it was formed and forged in the seemingly engulfing fire of white supremacy and its quote-unquote civilizing tendencies.